Welcome back. Having a good time? Nice and peaceful weekend. So this is our next conference, and we're just kind of walking our way through the Ten Commandments. We've talked about really just the first one, so I want to go through the next two just in this conference, and you know, maybe more if we have time. But the next one is often misunderstood. Don't take the Lord's name in vain. Don't take God's name in vain. You know, the classic phrase where that comes from, you know, if you're mad at someone and you say, you know, I wish that you go to hell, right? Well, the classical English phrase for that is you damn someone. So, you know, I damn you to hell. I'm wishing you to go to hell. That's a pretty dirty, rotten thing to say to anyone. If you say, God damn you, then you're asking God to do your dirty work. You know? It's like you're asking God to get behind your anger, your jealousy, your meanness, your spitefulness. Asking God to get behind that horrible, horrible motive. And so that's what we don't do. It also has the other connotation of when people say, I'm telling you the truth. I swear to God. Right? We do that in the courtroom and everything, but in normal conversation, we're asking God, and we're asking also for God to get behind what I'm saying, okay? When really, God would rather have it be based on our own credibility and not to kind of, you know, use him for our purposes. Reminds me years ago when I was driving and, you know, driving as normally down the street, et cetera. But then I saw that famous red light in my rearview mirror. So, having thought about it for about 2 seconds, I pulled over. And the policeman came up and he said, do you know why I pulled you over? And I said, why no, officer, I don't. And he said, well, you were speeding. And I said, well, officer, I can tell you quite clearly, I was not speeding. And he said to me, oh my gosh, I am so sorry. My apologies. Please accept my apologies. I ask your forgiveness. Please continue on as normal. That didn't happen. So, but wouldn't it be nice if your credibility was so powerful, so solid, so strong, that if you said that, people would automatically say, it's my mistake, I'm so sorry, you couldn't possibly. If you say you're not speeding, that's good enough for me. Continue on. Now, wouldn't it be great if we all had that level of credibility, right? This was what this commandment is about, is basically establishing that credibility that our word is absolutely solid and trustworthy. Now, my interaction with that policeman, that was the very first time I'd ever met, and I hope it's the last. But the way trust is built is never really on one-time events. Trust is only built over a long period of time. So good behavior over a long period of time. You know, one of the very best experiences we have in our human life is having an old friend, right? But you can't make old friends quickly. It takes time to have an old friend because they have stood the test of time over a period of time. So this is a beautiful commandment, and again, we're not talking about the Egyptians here. We're not talking about your children, your grandchildren, or your neighbors. This is a commandment that is, again, always only addressed to ourselves. Establish, you know, and you can pick any day that you want to start. Today's a good day. Start on this day establishing a habit of credibility and trust that whenever you speak, it's never an exaggeration, and it's never a diminution. It's the truth as you see it. Does that make sense? And this is a personal task. This is not something that you can pass on to someone else as saying, God, I swear to God I'm telling the truth, right? No, this is based on your credibility, your behavior over time. And so over time is a powerful way to establish trust. The other way is in challenging times. When things get tough, do you change your view? Do you change your loyalty, your faithfulness? The Egyptians were famous for changing their gods all the time based on circumstances. But this ties in with the first commandment to keep holy, to have no other false gods before me, to worship only God, in good times and in bad. And so when times get really tough, that's when we also keep our word. And we admire people who keep their word, especially in tough times. You know, I told you that my best friend is a senior official in the fire department, and he's going to retire in a few months. We were talking the other day, and I'm going to be speaking at his retirement event, and I was thinking of an image like this. You know, let's say that you're in the fire department, you're in the fire station, and the alarm goes off. And you know, they pick up the phone and go, what's going on? And you say, fire, my house is on fire. Come quick, my house is on fire. And the fireman says, oh my God, that sounds like it's very dangerous. When the fire's out, then we'll come over and take a look. It's way too dangerous to go now. When the fire's out, we'll go, you know. You don't want us to go when the fire's going on. One of the reasons why we admire firemen is because they precisely keep their word. We will come to your place even if it's on fire. In fact, especially if it's on fire. And we will go into the house if you are there. That's our commitment to you as a public servant. That's why they are considered, you know, with this remarkable word that we use, heroes. A hero is someone who is steadfast even in challenging, tough, hard times. So keeping our word over time and in tough times is kind of the background for this commandment. And you can imagine how this commandment would have sounded to these Israelites, especially when they are among Egyptians, who were the exact opposite. And this shows how the Israelites had their own culture, their own way of doing things. I remember my very first assignment. I'm in my 41st year of priesthood now, 41 years. So I'm in my first year. My first 4 years, I was stationed at a very difficult parish. And the pastor was actually considered to be one of the worst pastors in LA. He was actually told prior to me coming there that he was never going to get another associate because he was so bad. But he was a classmate of the guy who made the assignments. And so he pulled favors, and I was just ordained, and they, for a variety of reasons, they thought I would be okay there, so they sent me there. And it was everything that everybody said, you know. It was just a tough place. I was there 1 year when the other associate left the priesthood because it was such a dark place. And the next year, the other associate left the priesthood because he was so despondent and so dispirited. So I'm there 2 years, 2.5 years, and two of the other associates have left because of the climate and, you know, just the negativity of this guy. So at that point, the diocese sent a priest out to see me. Father Dave, are you doing okay? You know, I mean, and this is what they told me. They said, you know, this is a mistake. We're so sorry. We sent you here. We'd like to help you out. If you say so, you can leave right now, no questions asked, and you can go to any parish you want in the Archdiocese. So I said, how about Tahiti? No. So I said, they said, you can go to any parish you want. And I said, no, I'm not going anywhere. I just spent 12 years of my life in the seminary. I went to the high school seminary, college seminary, and graduate school. That's 12 years. So I just spent 12 years of my life learning how to be a priest. Why would I let someone like that affect me? I'm supposed to try to affect him. But why would I let him affect me? I'm staying here. So I had no effect on him whatsoever. But he had no effect on me, right? So I stayed my whole 4 years. I have never, ever cut short an assignment. You make a commitment, you die before you break that commitment. Now, if there's anything that you remember from this entire weekend, it's this next point, because this makes all the difference. I was in this very negative place with a very, very horrible pastor, and he was just devastating the parish and devastating these other priests. But I never let his lack of love affect mine. I never let his lack of faith affect mine. I never let his lack of hope affect mine. I made a commitment to grow in the virtues of faith, hope, and love. I will keep that commitment. Why would I let someone else change that? I cannot think of any more central theme for this weekend than that idea. Last night we started talking about families and the different dynamics that you have in families, and you have people who are irritating in your families. I can't believe that's true, but sometimes you tell me that there are irritating people in your family, annoying people, people who don't do what you want them to do. They're disappointed you by doing certain things. Fine. Never let their behavior change yours. This is what it means to be autonomous. This is what it means to be independent. This is what it means to be powerful. That you are the chooser of your behavior, not them. Does that make sense? So you never let someone else's lack of faith affect your faith. You can never say, if God forbid you should stand before the pearly gates today, you can never say, I would have had more faith if it wasn't for my kids. I would have had more hope if it wasn't for my husband. God will say, I gave you faith, hope, and love. Did you keep your promise? You cannot blame it on anyone else. This is the most liberating, freeing idea you can imagine, because now your day doesn't depend on the people that you meet, right? Otherwise, you get up in the morning and you say, gosh, I hope I only meet nice people today. Because if I don't, I'm going to lose every bit of love, faith, and hope that I have. Right? That's the old way of thinking. Here's the new way of thinking from this retreat. It doesn't matter who I meet today. I hope I meet nice people, but if I don't, I still have my faith, hope, and love to nurture and care for. Right? It doesn't matter what family I have. It doesn't matter what my children do or what my grandchildren do. It doesn't matter. I have to live my life of faith, hope, and love no matter what they do. I'm just going to let a couple of hours go by to let that sink in. So a famous story of Jesus. This has also got a lot of scholarly interest about it. Jesus walks into a town. This was John Paul II's favorite gospel. Jesus walks into a town, and he has a big crowd around him. They're all just watching him and waiting on him and just, you know, can't wait to see what he does next. And who shows up but what the gospel calls a rich young man? A very rare event to have someone rich and young. So this guy was clearly well known and obviously the key influential person in town. And he shows up and he asks Jesus a question: how do I get to heaven? This is really a fascinating question, because there's no frills about it. It's just a very blunt question. You can almost imagine a guy is on his way to a meeting. You know, he's a rich young man, he's aggressive, he's assertive, he's a guy on the move. He's going, Jesus, how do I get to heaven? Don't give me a story, don't give me a parable, I haven't got time. Just tell me how to get to him. And Jesus picks that up. And so we don't hear a parable, and we don't hear a sermon. Jesus says, keep the commandments, right? And the guy says, well, basically, long story short, Jesus explains how to get to heaven. And the rich young man says, thank you, but no thank you, and walks away, right? So Jesus, in front of the crowd, is humiliated because this is the master teacher, and he cannot close the sale, if you will, with the rich young man. So the rich young man walks away. What does Jesus do next? Anybody know? Nothing. He lets him go, right? He lets him go. He respects his freedom. He respects his intelligence. Jesus, the good shepherd, goes after the lost sheep because the sheep was lost, wanted to come back, just didn't know the way. The rich young man was not lost. He just had it perfectly explained to him, right? And Jesus lets him go. That's a very good model, right? You have people in your life that you've explained everything perfectly to, I'm sure. If they go, you let them go. I mean, you don't want to out Jesus. I know that's what you did, Jesus, but I have a better idea. It's probably not going to work out. So if we were going to follow Jesus, we follow that model. Now, here's why there's a lot of scholarly interest in this story. This story occurs in the Gospel of Mark. It is one of the most famous stories of all, and like I say, it was Pope John Paul II's favorite gospel. He built the entire encyclical Veritate Splendor on this gospel. The rich young man in the Gospel of Mark that went away, a lot of scholars today think that rich young man was Mark. And that later on, he changed his mind, he came back, became a follower of Christ, and then wrote his own story in the gospel. That make sense? One of the reasons they think that is because of this phrase. When the guy says, how do I get to heaven? Jesus looked at him with love. Now, who else would know that except the one who got the look, right? So remember I was talking about Matthew at the sermon today? Jesus looked at Matthew. And here's another story of the look of Jesus. Jesus looked at him with love, and he returned. But Jesus did not run after him, right? So remember, Jesus was humiliated. He lost the sale, but he did not let that change his faith, his hope, his love. He didn't despair. He didn't get angry. He wasn't mad. You know, this man didn't want it. I still have it. I have to do everything I can to nourish it and keep it going. So just to say again, we never let someone else's lack of faith, hope, and love affect ours. You will frequently find yourself surrounded by people without love, hope, and faith. Believe it or not, God is happy for you to be there. That's exactly where he wants you to be, amongst people who need it, right? Like the gospel today said, I did not come for healthy people, I came for the sick. So if you find yourself surrounded by lack of faith, hope, and love, let me congratulate you. You are exactly where our Lord would like you to be, because he would like you to be that shining example of it, no matter what is going on around you, right? And the resources that you will need to maintain that lead us to our next commandment. So how you're going to be able to do that will come from our next commandment, which is to keep holy the Lord's day. This is an incredibly rich commandment that has a lot of fruit, a lot of resources and wisdom for families, but especially marriages, especially marriages. So, keep holy the Lord's day. The nice thing about that is it's on a regular pattern every 7 days, all right? So, like any human being, you're going to have up days and down days, right? You're going to be in the mood and not in the mood. But the genius of doing something on a regular basis, no matter how you feel, is exactly that. It's not based on a feeling. It's based on a commitment. As an example, when you make a commitment to a newborn child, you don't welcome a child into a family and say, "Welcome to our family. Don't worry, I will feed you whenever I feel like it." And if I don't feel like it, there's the refrigerator. That's not going to work, right? And you know that instinctively. Nobody had to tell you, "I know you're tired, so you don't have to feed the baby." But that type of commitment, you know, that is not based on feelings, is actually the beginning of the source of human happiness. If our life is based on feelings, that is the absolute road to sadness, because feelings are unreliable, they come and go, they're unpredictable, and certainly life in a relationship cannot be based on something that's ephemeral and unpredictable and wild. So our life works to the extent that we keep our agreements and our commitments. Now, there's something else about this that's extremely powerful. So let's say we have a husband and wife, and, you know, acquaintance, friends, engaged, they get married, they're very much in love. Okay, let's just assume all the best in this kind of a perfect, beautiful situation. Even a couple that's very, very much in love are still two separate human beings. They didn't marry their clone. They married another human being who was born on a different day, had a different history, and has a different brain, and has a different mind, and on any given day is going to be thinking about something. And let's say it's, during the day, you have a child who does something happens at school that's bad. And so when the two of you get together in the evening, one of them says, "We've got to talk about our son. Something really bad happened at school." And the other person says, "Not now." Right? And then the other person gets really upset. "Are you kidding me? We have to talk about our son right now." I said, "No, I know, but there's something on my mind right now that's really important, and I can't talk about it right now. Let's talk about it later." Now, that reveals something that's counterintuitive. You may think that the person who wants to talk about it later is being rude or selfish. Actually, it's the other way around. The person who says, "I want to talk about this and I want to talk about it now," is the selfish person. Now, if you've done that, by way of explaining. Because one of the principles of our human life, the way God designed, remember I said yesterday and today, no, you're not in charge of someone else, right? Well, this is the corollary to that. Nobody has the right to command another person's attention. You can never say, "I command you to stand in front of me because I have a topic that I want to talk about." You do not have that right. You don't have that authority over another human being, except the child. I'm talking about fellow adults, right? Obviously, a kid can do that. You know, I told you I was born in New Jersey, and I moved to California when I was 9. People ask me sometimes, "How did you get to California?" I said, "Very easy. My folks said, 'Get in the car.'" So So everything I'm telling you is only about fellow adults. Obviously, you have a right to command children for their safety. Get out of the street, you know. But with another adult, you are a fellow adult. You are not over that person. Our Catholic understanding of the Adam and Eve story is that they were equal. As Adam says, this at last is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. That's a Hebrew phrase for equal. So in the Catholic faith, the husband is not over the wife and the wife is not over the husband. They are equal. So you cannot command someone else. But what you can say, what the two of them can say is, okay, you don't want to talk about it now. Let's set up a time to talk about it. We'll talk about it after dinner. Great. Now these two people have agreed to set aside a time in which they have both agreed to talk about this topic. Does that make sense? This is, by the way, how people fall in love in the first place. They go on dates in which they agree to meet at a restaurant or something and talk about meaningful things, and then they separate. And there's no problem with the separation because they know they're going to have another date later on to talk about these meaningful things. So what God has done in this commandment is set up a weekly date, right? God is saying, I'm not going to command your attention. Me, God, I'm not going to say it's Monday morning and I want to talk to you right now. God doesn't do that. He respects your freedom. He may even say, I know you're busy. I know you got a lot of stuff going on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday and Saturday, but that's okay. Because we have Sunday. Sunday is our date. And I will tell you my deepest story about myself, and you tell me your needs and things about yourself, and we will get it together. Does this make sense? So this command to meet on Sundays is not just like an obedient institutional thing. We have a membership meeting every Sunday. It's how relationships happen. And relationships happen on these dates because you cannot command a conversation. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't say that phrase. You can say, our son did something wrong at school, we have to talk about it now. That's perfectly okay to say, but it's also perfectly okay for the other person to say no. And you don't take it personally. And it doesn't bother you because why? Because you say, okay, I understand. I know we have our guaranteed time in the sun tonight after dinner in which we are going to talk about it. And it's going to be a more fruitful and productive conversation because you both had some time to think about it. So this idea of the keeping holy the Lord's Day is just an extremely, extremely powerful event. I recommend for people who are married to have not only their Sunday experience, but either daily or some other time during the week in which they agree that they're going to go together and the topic is going to be their relationship only. Not household management, not budget planning, and not even about the kids, but about yourself as a married couple. How are we doing as a married couple? If you do that on a weekly basis, it is almost impossible that a couple is going to drift from each other, right? And if you do it faithfully with God on Sunday, it's going to be impossible for you to drift apart from God as well. Does this make sense? All right. So a couple that I talked to years ago used to come up with a great phrase because they used to do a Friday night walk around the park, right? So they used to call it their intimate talk around the park, their intimate talk on a regular walk. That was it. Intimate talk on a regular walk. So it was regular, right? So just like Sunday Mass is regular, their Friday night deal was regular. So to the extent that this is going to sound counterintuitive, but love comes from talking. It has no other source. It comes from talking and is sustained by talking. Even a physical relationship is more meaningful when it is preceded by talking. So what do I mean by talking? Expression, human expression. You're taking what's inside of you and expressing it to someone else in a meaningful way. So let me just take five more minutes, if that's okay. Is that okay? To talk about the kinds of talk we do with God, the kinds of talk that we can do with each other, or even children, that is God designed to bring people together. So there's three ways of speaking about speech, or the kinds of talk that we have. One is emotional talk, the other is informational talk. So emotional talk, as you can imagine, is feelings, expressions of emotions. So you get together, and the first thing you say to your spouse or to your friend is, I am so angry at that car that cut me off tonight at the driving home. I could have killed that person. Okay, that's an honest expression, right? However, it's sometimes rather off-putting. Take it easy. It's expressing something, but it doesn't bring people closer. It often kind of distances themselves. The other kind of speaking is informational, and that's simply this. Yeah, tonight on the way home, a car cut in front of me pretty close. Really? It's factual, it's informational, but it's not very interesting. So that doesn't bring people close either. Okay. Now, the third type, the first two, emotional and informational, in all fairness, I will just say that they do have stereotypical gender roles, all right? Just over the centuries, typically gender-specific communication tends to be more feeling-oriented and emotional, and for men, it tends to be informational and data and factual, okay? There's nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't bring anyone close. There is a third type of communication that is non-gender-specific, equally distributed amongst men and women, but instantly brings people close. And that's called meaningful talk. Now, the definition of meaning is when you take an event and you put it in a larger context, right? We are having a retreat in Alhambra, which was within the city of Los Angeles, or in the county of Los Angeles. So I've taken this event and I've now related it to a larger context of geography. It's a geographical context. A little bit more interesting, but not that much. But let's go back to our conversation with the freeway. So the person comes home and says, I can't believe what happened. I was driving home, everything was fine, and all of a sudden a car almost cut me off. I could have gotten an accident. Can you imagine if I was gotten in an accident and gotten injured? That would have changed our family for the next 10 years. I mean, I could have been laid up and out of work for years. Oh my gosh, now we've taken one event on the freeway, and now we have seen its impact on the next 10 years of this family. Does that make sense? Let me tell you, the other person listening to that is gonna go like this. Really? Oh my God, that was so close. My God, for the grace of God, let's say a prayer of thanksgiving right now, right? Because you put something in a larger context. That's how people fall in love in the beginning also. When you're on these dates, are you talking about the Dodgers? Sometimes. It doesn't bring people close. It's friendly, but it doesn't make for a relationship. What makes for a relationship is this. What do you want to do for a living? How many children would you like? Why would you want that many or not that many? Do you want boys or girls? Where do you want to live? What do you want to do with your life? What do you want to do with your life? That's the most meaningful question of all. And that's interesting. You know, if it's like, what do you want to watch on TV tonight? Versus, where do you want to spend the rest of your life? And do not people think the most meaningful day of all is when someone said, I would like to spend the rest of my life with you? Did you get really moved when someone said, I would like to spend this afternoon with you? But if someone said, I would like to spend the rest of my life with you, that's a meaningful context, right? So the way human beings work is that we are free, autonomous, independent people. In order to engage with someone, you have to respectfully set it up, because you cannot command another person's attention. You can never say, I want to talk to you now, and I want to talk to you now forever. I mean, I want to talk to you right now. So you set it up, and then you have this type of meaningful conversation. So when you're at Mass, you can have a meaningful conversation with God. He's having a meaningful conversation with you. He's saying, where would you like to spend eternity? That's the longest context of all. So where would you like to spend eternity? All these things are very, very powerful, and they bring us closer together. So remember, the number one takeaway from this whole weekend is we never let someone else's lack of faith, lack of hope, lack of love affect ours, right? And the way that we grow in love and faith and hope is by having meaningful talk, meaningful conversations with the people around us, especially God, anytime, and with our family and friends when we set it up.